Adobe Express makes it quick and easy to create everything I need for my business. From social posts, TikToks and flyers, all in just a few clicks. Get Adobe Express for free. Search for Adobe Express to find out more.
Boost your Experian credit score. Boost your score, boost it high, space high. Boost your credit score to space with Experian Boost. Grab that boost high. Boost your credit score instantly for free. Only with Experian. Free Experian account linked to your current account is required. Score increase subject to status.
Hello and welcome to Immigrantly. I am your host, Sadia Khan. We are recording this 2 days after the 2024 elections, so there are a lot of emotions. I am still contending with exhaustion and fatigue. I am numb. I don't know what to feel and what to think at this point. But you know what? I still believe in our shared humanity and that as a society, we will come together and all of us belong. We are good. We are good people. We are strong. We have agency. We have agency even through our vulnerability. Today, I have a special guest, Petra Molnar. She is a distinguished lawyer and anthropologist specializing in migration, technology, and human rights. She serves as the Associate Director of the Refugee Law Lab at York University and is a faculty associate at Harvard's Berkman Klein Center for Internet and Society. As the co-creator of the Migration and Technology Monitor, she critically examines technological experiments affecting people crossing borders. Her recent book, The Walls Have Eyes, Surviving Migration in the Age of Artificial Intelligence, published in May of this year. The book delves into the intersection of AI and migration, offering insights from her extensive on-the-ground research. On a personal note, as an immigrant who came to the US 20 years ago, I am deeply moved by her mission because I have seen how systems and policies shape the immigrant experience and impact our dignity along the way. And honestly, Petra's dedication to humanizing migrant stories aligns closely with our mission at Immigrantly, which is to amplify immigrant voices in a world that often reduces us to a statistic. So I'm really thrilled to dive into a conversation that will challenge our understanding of technology, migration, and what it truly means to protect human rights in the digital age. So let's get started. Welcome to Immigrantly. How are you doing?
Thank you so much for having me. Well, you know, I'm doing as well as one can be doing these days after the election.
Yeah, for listeners, we are recording this interview 2 days after the elections. And I had a lot of questions for you, Petra. And I went back and looked at my list of questions and I was like, okay, where do I start? I'm so lost right now. And I'm still processing the outcome. But I don't know. I think it's probably the advocacy activism fatigue that's set in. I feel more numb than anything else. How are you feeling in terms of the outcome and all that's happening?
Yeah, I think numb really resonates. I have to say, I was shocked but not surprised, I guess. You know, I'm not an American, right? I'm in America the last 2 years for work. I've been tracking migration issues since 2008. I remember the first Trump election. It's horrible to even say that, right? But the first Trump election in 2016, and that was maybe more shocking than this one somehow, seeing how the trends have been going. But it was incredibly disappointing, of course. And just, I stayed up all night, like many listeners, I'm sure, right, watching the results roll in. And then the following morning, I had a really incredible conversation with my colleague. She's a professor in Toronto. Her name is Ethel Tungohan, and she's a political scientist. And we did the same thing in 2016, being like, what just happened? And what does this mean for our sector, for our communities, for the greater advocacy movement? And it's just hard to know. It's hard to know how this is going to shape up. But it's been, yeah, shocking, but not surprising, I think, for many of us.
What was that conversation like?
You know, we just wanted to kind of come together and have a bit of community. We did this in 2016, like I said, when Trump got elected. And I remember back then I was a new lawyer. I was representing people in immigration detention who were facing deportation. And I had this terrible hearing that went just horribly wrong. And I was like, this is the manifestation of, you know, Trump's world. And then I remember I guest taught in Ethel's class, and we were trying to find a way to support and hold space for her students who were experiencing the shock of the Trump election back then. And so we were reflecting on that and what has happened in the last 8 years and what this is going to mean for our sector now. And, you know, there was a lot of rage. There was a lot of numbness, a lot of disappointment. But I have to say there was also this kind of incandescent resistance or hope or something, because it was like, no, okay, well, we need to also find ways to come together and talk about this and process this, but also find a way forward.
I like what you're saying, but when you say this was manifestation of Trump-era policies, I wonder if that's even true. Because to me, when I think of American immigration system, it has centered around deterrence. It has centered around dehumanization of certain communities. And yes, rhetorically, Democrats are not as expressive, but practically and policy-wise, I don't see much difference. Am I being too, I don't know, jaded?
No, not at all, Sadia. I think I feel the same. You know, I'm someone who studies surveillance and how new technologies are impacting the way that people move. And actually, it's a lot of the Democratic administrations that push forward extremely problematic border policies, not to mention, you know, just at the US-Mexico border, but internationally speaking as well. And yeah, I mean, if you look at like Obama's records on deportation, for example, hugely high, right? Foreign interventions, a lot of that happens under Democratic administrations, not to mention the Democratic stance on the genocide in Gaza.
Yeah.
I mean, like, yeah, this is all part of the same conversation, really, right?
And that's why when I look at election 2024, I am not surprised. I'm not shocked. Yes, I'm disappointed. I wish the outcome was different. But at the same time, I am so disillusioned by both Democrats and Republicans. And look, Republicans have shown who they are, their ideology, what they believe in, what they are going to do, how they look at individuals who are not part of the dominant population. But it's the Democrats who've really, really disappointed me. And this disappointment has lingered on for so long. We'll pivot to your book and your work because, Petra, it's so fascinating. I've been listening to your podcast interviews. I've been reading about your work. It's just mind-blowing to me how we have this new frontier of AI technology that's been deployed at the border, that's deployed as a test run to see how it can be used to control humans. And you've written a book which is called The Walls Have Eyes. Tell me, what are walls witnessing in this moment?
The book is a manifestation of 6-7 years of work across different borders around the world to try and understand how new technologies are shaping the way that people move. And the Walls of Eyes is actually something that a person said to me when I was doing work at the Greek-Turkey border. And it was a reflection on the kind of omnipresent surveillance that a lot of people are feeling when they live in border communities or as they're passing through borders, this kind of introduction of high risk and often unregulated technology that, again, shapes the way that people move. And this runs the ambit from drones, cameras, walls with sensors, things that maybe listeners have come across. But it also includes a lot of more violent, draconian pieces of technology, too, like robo-dogs, AI lie detectors, sound machines that are rolled out to the border that emit a piercing shriek to make it difficult for people to get close. All of these really dystopic uses of tech. And it's a global issue. This cross-cuts so many of the places that I've really had the privilege to work in and visit over the course of the work. It tries to stitch a global story together because it really is a global issue that I think is just now coming to light in some ways.
You call it dystopic. Some may call it border security. How do you parse it out?
That's very, very well put. If you look at the framing, both by governments, but also by the private sector, definitely border security and migration management is the framing that we see, right? There's even the World Border Security Expo, for example, right? And all of these kind of things that conflate, you know, military-grade technology with surveillance and with border management. And I think what helps me to think about it is to try and strip it down and look at some of the logics that animate how these issues are framed, right? And if we know that in the current global environment that's motivated by fear, migration is a quote-unquote problem. And if the state wants to solve the problem, quote-unquote, of migration, technological companies come in and say, hey, we have a solution for you to this problem, and that is a robo-dog or a drone or AI. And you really see this kind of framing of painting communities on the move as threats, as frauds, as dangerous, as terrorists. And this has been with us for decades. But there is now this kind of new manifestation of it through what some people call techno-solutionism, right? Using technical solutions for societal problems. And we need to unpack that. Who is a problem, so to speak, right? Who needs to be made intelligible? Who is made manageable? And it often is communities that are on the margins, like people on the move.
Fear profiteering, right? Why do you think, and again, I'm playing devil's advocate here. Why do you think migrants are not a problem?
Well, because migration has been with us since time immemorial. People have been moving and shifting across the globe since we started walking on two legs, right? And it's interesting because I think in the current conversations, we've lost sight of that. We've lost sight of the fact that movement, human movement, is something that is part of the human condition, right? And the borders that are so tightly controlled right now are also fairly recent, right? Sometimes they are a colonial construct or they are a neoliberal construct. They're not as immovable or fixed as we like to think they are.
Why do you think we've lost sight of that? Why have we really bought into this new narrative of border security, migrants are dangerous, they are a problem, we need to fix this problem? How did we get to this point?
Oh, I mean, it's a complicated history, right? Because we could go as far back and start kind of trying to understand the way that even states as a concept were introduced, right? These kind of parcels of land and economics and politics that rip the world apart in its kind of current manifestation. I mean, there's always been, since the introduction of the kind of modern state, there have been conversations about how to manage the flow of people, right? You can think back to Ellis Island in New York when people were arriving a couple hundred years ago. But there's been an intensification of the kind of conflation between fear and what sometimes people call criminalization of migration or crimigration, right? Painting the person on the move as a criminal. A lot of that can be tied to, for example, things like 9/11. There was a massive shift in the West after that event, of course. But even more recently, you know, I think as more and more technologies play into the way that borders are managed, it seems to always come down to, again, the foundational logic being that people on the move are somehow uncontrollable and have to be managed. And technology is doing the work for the state now to do that.
And you mentioned 9/11. When I think of it, it's mostly how 9/11 is weaponized to make border security, dehumanization a plausible imperative in American psyche, right? Is that true?
I definitely think so. It was such a pivotal event in so much of the policymaking conversations around migration and border security. And it also created a reverberatory effect across the world, right? Because, you know, not to give America too much power geopolitically, right? But so much of the decision making and the framing around issues like migration proliferates into other spaces like the European Union, like Canada, like Australia. And then it creates this kind of global world order that is predicated on the assumption that people who move are a threat and have to be managed. But, you know, I don't want to get too technical, but we can also look at it from a legal perspective, right? Because if you look at the way that the law treats people on the move or refugees specifically, it is also about the framing around categories and the way that we even think about how somebody attains refugee status. By this, I mean, in the law, we sometimes call it a reverse onus principle. So in criminal law, you are innocent until proven guilty, at least in most jurisdictions. Not all, but most. But in immigration and in refugee processing, it's the opposite. You are not a refugee until proven otherwise. You have to prove that you are not a liar, that you are truthful, that your story matters. Then you go through the refugee definition, you go through the tests that are there, and then you are proven to be a refugee, right? And, you know, we can debate the plausibility of reversing that and all of this, but I think it just shows that, again, the foundational kind of markers of how our entire refugee and immigration systems have been built globally are predicated on this idea that people are lying, cheating the system, not a refugee until proven otherwise, right? And it just gets us thinking, I think, about, again, the structures of power that underpin why decisions get made in immigration.
Petra, let's bring technology into this. Now, you worked in diverse regions, right? You worked in Kenya, Palestine, Philippines. How do technological interventions differ across all these different contexts?
So I think anytime you do a comparative piece of work, it's important to not conflate different areas of the world. And I was, you know, really lucky to get a sense of comparison across different places that are using and testing different technology. And, you know, for example, in places like East Africa and Kenya, that's where you see a lot of biometric technology being tested out, because we've had refugees living in camps like Dadaab and Kakuma for decades. But there's also moves to, for example, introduce digital identification system like the Huduma Namba in Kenya or the Aadhaar system in India. But as you kind of try and trace the way that people move across the globe and you come to regions like the European Union or the US-Mexico border, that's where you see a lot of the sharp surveillance. By this, I mean, you know, the drones, the cameras, the AI-powered towers that are, interestingly enough, an Israeli piece of technology that has made its way onto U.S. territory, and also really experimental projects like RoboDogs.
It seems like Israel is at the forefront of AI technology, especially when it comes to border security and militarization. Talk to me about how this technology is being used in places like Gaza and occupied West Bank as a test run on Palestinians, basically.
Yeah, absolutely. And this was one of the central pieces to the story for me. I felt like the book and my own understanding of the world would not be complete without addressing and actually going into the occupied West Bank to try and see firsthand what Israel has been doing. And you're absolutely right. I mean, Israel is one of the major players in the kind of economy that's grown up around border technology. And what happens is Israel tests out a lot of the surveillance and automated weaponry now also, as we've been seeing in Gaza, on Palestinians, and then exports it and sells it to willing buyers. And those buyers oftentimes are the European Union and the United States. And so you then start stitching together this tapestry that centers on Israel, but of course it's not the only player. It's such an important key to trying to understand how globalized this really is. And I have to also say, you know, I mean, I've been working in this sector for a long time, and I thought I understood, you know, the apartheid regime that's at play, but you don't really get it until you're there. You know, you get a smattering of it, at least, of course, because I have the privilege of leaving the region, right? But having the chance to go to the occupied West Bank, and this was in the spring of 2023, before October 7th, and seeing some of the way that the technology has been used to oppress Palestinians for decades was incredibly eye-opening. And I've also learned a lot, you know, from people who have been doing work there for many, many years. There's incredible Palestinian activists that are pushing for digital rights of Palestinians for many years. And also the work of journalist Anthony Lewinstein comes to mind. He's a Jewish Australian journalist who wrote a fascinating book called The Palestine Laboratory. And it is all about the way that Israel tests out technology and then sells it to the rest of the world. I would highly recommend that book to your listeners.
What was the most shocking part of you being there and discovering something that you did not expect?
There were so many things. I mean, I think one of the key sites that comes to mind would be Hebron, the occupied city of Hebron in the West Bank, because it is this laboratory of surveillance and automated weaponry, and also the way that, you know, just even the geography is used to curtail the movement of Palestinians by, for example, not allowing them to use certain roads. You know, it is this kind of omnipresent mechanism of surveillance and control and violence. And you feel it. You feel it viscerally when you're on the streets there. I think it's something that stays with you forever, that feeling of control and oppression that just is steeped through the air.
Petra, the way you're describing it, it's so dystopian, right? And it is so dehumanizing. But sitting in the U.S., why aren't people here able to connect with the dehumanization, the tragedy, the atrocities that are really unfolding in places like Gaza? What is the missing link here?
You know, I think it goes back to what we were talking about a little while ago, and that's the politics of fear and dehumanization in the way that certain communities are talked about in policy, but also in the media, right? I mean, you compare the ways that Palestine and the loss of life in Palestine is talked about, right, in the New York Times versus, you know, another publication that is not based in the West.
In the fucking New York Times. Isn't that tragic?
Right, right. But it just goes to show how particular framings that are predicated on, you know, powerful states like Israel take precedence, right? And even using passive language, like, you know, I don't know, thousands of Palestinians lost their lives. Like, how did they lose their lives, right? Like, language matters. And I think a lot of it has to do with, yeah, just decades-long framings like this. But I will say, you know, it's been obviously so horrific what's been happening. But one thing that I was surprised by, and let me say it this way, when I returned from the West Bank, this was the spring of 2023, I was like, this is so intractable. I have no idea how this is going to change ever. And it was so depressing, honestly. And then October 7th happened, and it's been horrific, of course. But I have to say, I have been so heartened by how many people now talk about Palestine, read about Palestine, show up for Palestinians. Absolutely. The student movements in the encampments, the way that, you know, junior academics are putting their careers on the line, the way journalists are choosing to write differently. I mean, I would not have imagined this before.
There has been some proliferation of factual news happening through social media and through what we are seeing on our screens, right? It's predicated on what you're seeing on screens. It's not the governments. It's not the mainstream media that is giving you accurate information, right? That dichotomy still exists. Petra, I want to circle back to migration. Now, I am an immigrant. I came to the U.S. some 20-odd years ago. Migration has historically been about survival, freedom, hope. I feel like migrants are OG risk takers. Whether forced or voluntary, displacement is not easy. Moving to a new country is not easy. Restarting your life is not easy. there is a physical, a mental toll that people undergo when they're going through that process. With AI and other technologies increasingly governing migration, the way you're describing it and the way you've described it in your book, do you think we risk reshaping migration as fundamentally transactional, governed by fear, by economics, stripping away human elements?
That's such a good reading of it, Sadia, and I'm so glad you framed it this way, because that is kind of the undercurrent in the book and in the work that I try and kind of take, because it is absolutely about that. It is about how technologies are not just changing the kind of operational reality of migration, so to speak, but also the kind of ephemeral relational sides of things, right? I mean, we already know, as you so poignantly just said, right, there's so much difficulty associated with movement and migration, ongoing trauma, intergenerational issues, right, like the kind of violence that's inherent in the bureaucracy of immigration. And we already know that the decisions that get made are opaque, they're discretionary, sometimes they're difficult to understand. So what happens when we then put a veneer between a decision maker and a person on the move, and that veneer is technology? If we start augmenting or replacing human decision making with automation, what is that going to do to the nuances of a person's story, right? Or the kind of way that we can talk about difficult things? A project comes to mind that I think illustrates this quite well, and that is this project that was pushed forward by the European Union called iBorder Control. By the way, the names are fascinating, right?
Yeah.
You have like an iPhone.
Is it like I?
Yeah, exactly.
Oh my God.
And so now we have iPhone, iPad, and iBorder Control. And essentially, this was a pilot project that tried to create an AI lie detector to be used at the border using facial recognition and micro-expression analysis. I mean, we could talk for hours about like, A, whether this even works, because it's been debunked essentially as snake oil technology. But I want to kind of attack it from a, you know, a refugee law perspective, or maybe just like a human to human perspective. Because how can an AI lie detector deal with differences in cross-cultural communication, for example? Like when I used to practice law in Canada, I had quite a few cases where people I was representing maybe we're not making eye contact with a judge of the opposite gender because of religion, their background, maybe because of nerves. And human decision makers...
Or cultural reasons.
Exactly. But human decision makers struggle with that, right? And they say, oh, this person's shifty-eyed, therefore maybe they're lying, right? Or maybe more subtly, what about the impact of trauma on memory? And the fact that we know that we don't tell stories in a linear way anyway, let alone some of the most difficult things that you have to parlay to a human decision maker, right? Humans struggle with this already. How can an AI lie detector do any better if it's a social construct and it's created in our discriminatory, unequal society that's full of power differentials? That's the issue here, that technology is exacerbating the problems that are already inherent in our immigration system and creating new ones too.
And technology is created by humans. So all the biases or preconceived notions of how to treat certain communities do manifest in those algorithms, don't they?
Absolutely. That's exactly it. That's where we have to start. The fact that technology is a social construct. It is not something that fell to us from the sky, but it is socially created, just like law, just like language, like policymaking, everything. And of course, it acts as a lens or a mirror that reflects back the way that our society currently is. And so if our society is predicated on white supremacy, historical racism, apartheid, you know, then of course it's going to be reflected in the technology that's pushed forward, especially if the powerful actors are the ones who are pushing it forward.
Petra, for a minute, let's flip the script and see how we can use this technology for good, right? So if you could design an ideal ethical framework for AI use in migration that really centers on migrants' perspectives, what fundamental principles would you include?
See, I would push it even a step further, and this is where my lawyer hat comes on. And I would actually say that ethics are good, but we actually need some rules-based lawmaking around this. We need a conversation that centers the human rights and human dignity of people on the move and actually puts some guardrails around the development and deployment of certain technologies, whether that's a ban or a moratorium, something like that. I mean, I just don't think it's ever going to be rights respecting to have discriminatory algorithmic decision making or robodogs or AI lie detectors. And then if there is technology that is going to be used, then absolutely, it has to be ethical. It has to recognize human dignity as a starting point. And it also has to be participatory. That's what you precisely just said, and I think that's such an important point. The people on the move and affected communities have to be in the driver's seat when it comes to the development of technology. And if I can plug one of the projects that we've been incubating at the lab where I work, it's called the Migration and Technology Monitor. And through this project, we fund people on the move specifically to tell our own stories on what matters when it comes to migration and tech. And it's been really fascinating because some of my colleagues on the move look at issues of surveillance and how it's impacting people on the move, for example, at the US-Mexico corridor, using, analyzing the way that, for example, the CBP1 facial recognition app is discriminatory against women. But there's also people who are looking at the positives of technology, designing chatbots by and for mobile communities, using online psychosocial archival technology, really fascinating ways of using tech, again, to try and level at least some of the power differentials.
What are some of the technologies that migrants are using or can use to basically navigate, resist, or even reshape their own journeys?
This is actually the topic of my second book, which is I'm currently working on right now. So very happy to talk about it.
I like that.
I have to look at some of the positives and some of the more joyful resistance that's in the space too, because this book is quite dark and dystopic. And that only tells, a part of the story. So for sure, there's been, I think, a trend of trying to use technologies that are assistive in the sense of, for example, giving people access to information in a more ready way. So whether that's a chatbot or whether that's, online platforms that people on the move themselves have been designing, that's really been fascinating to see. There's also been an interesting kind of use of social media by people on the move. For listeners who are interested in that, I would urge you to take a look at, for example, TikTok and the way that people on the move have been using it, or Migrant Talk, as people talk about it.
Expand some more.
Yeah, so this is really interesting because you see people on the move, often young, right? Like doing almost like a piece to camera selfie video while they're on a boat or they're going through a border crossing saying, hey guys, this is my experience, this is what I'm doing, sharing information this way. There's also a dark side to it because we've also seen human traffickers, use these platforms too to solicit for clients. But I find it fascinating from a kind of agency perspective that people on the move are sharing their own stories in a way that we haven't really seen before, until we've had access to platforms like this. That's a fascinating element to it as well. And the last kind of set of, technologies that could be seen as resistive are also ways of trying to flip the script, so to speak, on the tech that's currently being used. And, instead of, for example, using AI lie detectors at the border, calling for the use of AI to root out racist border guards or to audit immigration decision makers, right? To kind of turn it on the powerful actors, right?
I like that. How are we ensuring that these algorithms or technologies are created by people who understand different perspectives, who come from different cultural backgrounds, who understand the nuances of, migration, immigration, different cultures? Are there any measures to ensure that we have a more diverse group of people creating technology?
Yeah, that's such an important piece to the story, paying attention to who's around the table when we innovate and why. And, I don't want to paint an entire sector with a broad brush because, of course, there's people with diverse perspectives and different lived experience in the tech sector. But the trends I've seen and the people that I speak with oftentimes, it is a very white, male, privileged space. And you see that sometimes reflected even in the kind of conversations that you can have, right? Like when I'm meeting with private sector folks, sometimes I go around the room and I ask a couple cheeky questions, right? Like, oh, you know, who's a computer scientist? A couple hands go up. Oh, who's interested in code? A couple hands go up. Who's ever been to a refugee camp? Usually no one. Who's ever had to apply for welfare? Not many people. Who's ever sat in front of a judge in a criminal sentencing hearing? Not a lot of people. And that's just to show, right, that there is this divide between the way that we develop technology in these silos and then kind of wash our hands of it and say, well, you know, our client's now using it. It's not my problem anymore. This kind of pipeline effect, right? But I think people who are in positions of power and who are the ones designing this need to see the life cycle of their projects and how often it actually is harming and hurting real communities.
You know, that's so important, Petra, because more than who those people are and what their profile is, it's important for them to educate themselves. We should have mandatory training for these people to understand the process of migration, the impact it has, and difficulties that migrants face, and the reasons for migration in general. So it's almost as if we are saying it's okay for a white privileged male to create that technology and be at the table as long as they are more intentional about what the process really looks like, what migration really means. Have they spoken to migrants? Have they spoken to immigrants? Have they gone through the process themselves? The simulation of that journey becomes such an important piece that we are missing right now.
I think ultimately it goes to seeing the people that are affected by what you're designing as human beings, you know, and not feeding into these dehumanizing narratives of, well, this is, you know, the after effect of technology, but it's a human being, right? And I think so much of that, yeah, has to do with just differences in lived experience and this kind of siloing of the way that we work in the tech space, right? It's like you have the engineers here, the lawyers there, the civil society here, the affected communities there, without actually sitting around the same table. And I think the other point, though, is too about challenging the way, like you said, technology and design is taught, right? Like, what kind of mandatory courses are there for engineers and coders, right? Do they have to take a human rights law class, right? Do they talk to a refugee or an incarcerated person, for example? And also, do we challenge the starting presumption that we actually even need more technology? Because sometimes we just could use the resources for other things in this space. Like, we don't need another app. We don't need more surveillance, right? Like, we need to actually also take apart the foundational kind of starting point that more tech is better.
We'll have to look at the money trail, right? It's profitable. I think that piece is going to stay because of how lucrative and how profitable technology has become. And again, living in capitalistic societies, we really cannot erase something or even mitigate its effects if it is so profitable. So this goes back to, if something is so profitable, how do we resist? How do we hold it accountable, right? How effective is civil society in this? Because sustenance for them, for civil society, is also connected to donors and member states and private corporations. It's a dark web, an entanglement of all these different elements. I worked in civil society and I know how it operates. I worked with UN bureaucracy and I know how that operates. And I've sat through meetings with member states and I know what they want. I know I sound so jaded, but honestly, I don't have much trust in those systems either.
Oh, you and me both. You know, one of my favorite books is called The Revolution Will Not Be Funded. And it's basically about the NGO industrial complex. And it's absolutely part of it. It's an actor that also has to be critiqued. And I see this daily, right? Like, running a research lab that relies not only on government funding, but also on foundations. And the kind of political back and forth that happens, right? With, like, needing to please your donor with specific ways that you're shaping, you know, the projects that you're proposing. I mean, it's all part of the same kind of economy, so to speak. One way for me to be able to survive, I think, in that space is a commitment to the redistribution of resources, you know, and that's something that we try and do at the Monitor project that I mentioned, where we pay people on the move a living wage for a year through a fellowship program, very few strings attached. They just have to work on something on border tech. And that's a great way of just like literally getting money directly into communities that are affected. But, you know, who knows how long this will last. So I'm trying to make the most of it while we have funding.
Right, right. But how do you navigate the funding space, though?
Yeah, I mean, it's a tricky one, because when we started the Monitor Project and the lab that I work at, the kind of migration and technology space, this was, you know, 5 years ago or so, was pretty new. You know, like there were people working on biometrics and surveillance generally, but there wasn't this kind of proliferation of work. And I think it was quite attractive to funders to try and support innovative research. And then we quickly pivoted to working directly again with experts on the move, our colleagues who are in affected communities directly. And so far that's been okay. But, you know, of course, you know, we had to think a lot about sustainability and commitment to communities over the long term, right? We don't want to be one of these projects that's just like a flash in the pan, which happens a lot, right? And then also with Israel Palestine, right? Like that was a thought that I had at some point, because it's very clear like what my politics are and what the politics of our colleagues in our project is, right? And we're like, well, are we going to lose funding over this? And I thought, well, you know, no, we didn't actually. We were lucky that we didn't. Yeah. But, you know, we thought it's a hard thing to sit with, right? Because I remember having this thought deep, dark on an evening being like, you know, if this lab shuts down, that's, you know, 15 people who will lose their jobs, right? It's not just me anymore, but there's people who rely on this work, right? But then on the other hand, we would never take money from a funder that would have issues with us being pro-Palestine. So in the end, it was like, well, if we have to shut down, we will shut down. And that is what it is. And luckily, it didn't pan out that way. I know for many other groups, they struggle, right? And it's just been a moment of clarity, I think, in so many ways for many of us in the sector.
Petra, if you could tell me one story from your research or field work that you think the world really needs to hear, that shaped your understanding of human experiences related to migration, can you share any story?
Oof, yeah, there's quite a few stories that come to mind. And I should say that the book is really story-driven. It tries to highlight the impact of tech on real people's lives. And each kind of area that I explore is told through the story of a particular person or a community that's working there. But I think for your listeners, I want to reflect a little bit on what's been happening in Arizona, for example. That's a corridor of movement. People have been migrating through the Sonora Desert for many years and unfortunately also dying in the desert, because it's a very inhospitable environment. And it also is this test bed, this laboratory of tech experimentation. This is where we see AI towers that are an Israeli company, for example, drones, and all sorts of other draconian pieces of technology. I was really lucky because when I started working in that region, I started working with search and rescue groups and Samaritan groups that are very active in the region. And it's fascinating because a lot of them are also like retirees. They're 70 and 80 year olds who, instead of being on a sun lounger, drive into the Sonora Desert to drop water, to support people in distress, and sometimes also deal with human remains.
So they're really supporting people in distress. Oh, wow.
They are. And also sometimes, unfortunately, finding human remains. And when I was there a couple of years ago, we trekked through the Sonora for about 3 hours with Battalion Search and Rescue, which was started by James Holman, who's a former Marine who didn't really work in migration and then just was so incensed with what was happening in his home state that he basically retired early and then started this group. And so we went into the desert and ended up going to a memorial site of Mr. Elias Alvarado, who was a young husband and father from Central America, who came in search of a better life and unfortunately died just hours away from a major highway. And it was really moving, you know, to be in that space. It was this dusty arroyo or a riverbed in the Sonora. And there was this beautiful orange cross that a migrant group, Los Armadillos, made for him. And the cross was washed away in the river that was there a few months ago. And we had to look for it and search for it and kind of put it back up there. And it was such a beautiful kind of moment of care. But then a day or two later, in one of the most surreal moments of my career, and if you choose to read the book, you'll see I've had many. We were on the sands of the Sonora paying respects to Mr. Alvarado and interacting with the inhospitable but beautiful environment. The Department of Homeland Security announced that, you know, AI towers and drones are not enough, that robo-dogs are now going to be the latest manifestation of this border tech regime. A robo-dog is essentially something you might see on like an episode of Black Mirror or a sci-fi show. It's a quadruped, military-grade piece of technology. Sometimes they're armed, as they have been in Palestine. And it was just so shocking to see, you know, the space and the people working in it and reflect on the journey of Mr. Alvarado. And then you just can't help but think, like, will people on the move be chased by robo-dogs? I mean, it's just so stark, that that kind of duality of that space. That really is something that stays with me.
What a sad contradiction. Petra, in the end, if you could define the United States of America in the context of border security and surveillance, how would you do that?
It's a good question. I always, I think, as a non-American, don't want to give the U.S. too much power, because so much of conversations is centered around the United States, and rightly so, because it's an incredibly powerful geopolitical player. But I think what it does highlight in the conversations around border tech and surveillance is that money talks, and it's coming from the centers of capitalism. And unfortunately, that is a trend that I think we're going to see in the years to come.
That's the irony. That's exactly what's happening. Pick any sector. Money talks. Wow. Petra, thank you so much for this wonderful conversation. We would love to have you back once the other book comes out. You're doing an incredible job. What you're doing is brave, and very few people are able to do it and then talk about it so unapologetically. So thank you for that. Where can people find your book?
Thank you so much, Sadia, and to your team for having me and for having such a good conversation. And if people are interested in the book, you can find it at your local independent bookstore or also on Amazon and Target. Interestingly enough, it's called The Walls of Eyes. And I promise it's not too academic, and it is story driven.
Thank you, Petra. This was wonderful.
Thank you so much.
You know, I keep thinking, how do we connect the human piece in all of this? How do we make other people see the humanity in people on the move, refugees, migrants, asylum seekers, immigrants? We use these terms so often, but we never take a moment to pause and understand what these terms really mean. All these labels are connected to other people. They are connected to stories and journeys that may not be ours, but they exist. And I implore all of you, for the sake of our shared humanity, especially now, to rethink and recalibrate yourselves when you think of these different labels, because they are not labels, they are humans, they are stories, they are life trajectories, they are tragedies sometimes. Please don't forget that. This podcast episode was produced by me, Sadia Khan, written by me. The editorial review is done by Shay Yu. Our editor and sound designer is Lou Raskin. Our theme music is done by Simon Hutchinson. Other music by Epidemic Sound. Come back next week when I share another important conversation. Oh, and by the way, for Thanksgiving, I may just share one of our other podcasts' Thanksgiving episode. So stay tuned for that. Take care and be kind to others.